a number of people. I think Brian Meeks, who's a pretty well-known political scientist these days from the Caribbean. Is he Jamaican? I think he's Jamaican. I know he was also involved in Abeng anyway. A number of people were involved in it. And this became a mass grassroots movement that galvanized a large section of the population and also felt the repression of the Jamaican government. But I was also mentioning that it's been said that there were Canadian troops in Jamaica that were carrying out exercises in the event of any serious kind of rebellion. And the same was said in Trinidad in 1970, it's been said. So that connection is there. So that's a major development in Jamaica's history that came out of this thing. It's also a major development in Pan-African history, because it meant that Walter would go back to Trinidad, where he was very influential at a very important period in African history, where they had this experiment, if you call it that, that came out of the Arusha Declaration in Tanzania. And he, in his own way, played a very influential role among students that came in his circle, and quietly in the public sphere, but mostly centered around the university to influence, you know, later intellectuals and so on. You know, on questions of socialism, this notion of African socialism and so on. But that evolved as a result of him not being able to teach in the Caribbean, because it was just the University of the West Indies as far as English speaking Caribbean goes. So he went back to Tanzania after not being allowed to teach in the Caribbean, but you know, the other university is University of Guyana, but other than that, it's University of West Indies. But he spent some time in Cuba before that, but more important, he spent some time here in Montreal, more time in Montreal as a result of that. After Sir George, when these students were arrested, there were major protests throughout the Caribbean too. One of the protests, which took place in Trinidad, it sort of coincided or was in part sparked by outrage at the arrest of the students, and then the Governor General of Canada, Michener is his name, so Governor Michener, visiting Trinidad to sort of allay people's fears and, you know, kind of, you know, public relations, part appeasement. And in attempting to speak on the university campus, the students prevented him from speaking. And that mobilization led into a demonstration, which involved into a broader movement, which, you know, Michener's presence and the events of Sir George sort of symbolize Canadian involvement in Trinidad and the Caribbean at large. They protested in front of the Canadian embassy and also in front of the Royal Bank. I think there was even some destruction involved. And this became a movement sparked by Sir George that almost toppled the Eric Williams government. It evolved into this broad sweeping thing that involved unions, including the largest union, the Oilfield Workers Trade Union, and all sectors of society, African and Indian. And that in of itself is a whole other story, but in direct and indirect ways was very much influenced by developments at Sir George and also developments in Canada in general. And I'm saying all that to say, like, I mean, that knowing that has a value on its own terms. There's an inherent value in, you know, just understanding, like, the broad sweep of this history. But again, it goes back to, you know, events organized by a small group of people. Even if you take in, like, you know, as I mentioned, all the people that were involved in the conference committee initially, you know, including, like, the core members, so to speak, the women that were involved, some of whom were part of the core and so on. all of this sort of evolved into all of these other things. And it goes with saying, you know, you don't know when you start something. You know, you're doing it with, you know, all you have is your convictions. You don't know where this thing is going to end. And, you know, Franklin Harvey, part of the conference committee, was one of the founders of MAP, Movement for the Assemblies of People, which precipitated and evolved into the New Drill Movement, along with some other groupings. And Franklin Harvey himself, who maintained very close contact with C.L.R. James throughout, very close contact. He's one of James' real proteges. He and Bobby Hill, Alfie to a lesser extent, but they were all James' proteges. Franklin Harvey could have been Morris Bishop, meaning that, you know, given his theoretical background and so on, they looked to him to be the leader of New Drill. He declined, largely because he felt that the movement should evolve in a more organic direction, more along the lines of, going back to James' notion of the party, where, you know, you have these assemblies where people, you know, it becomes a talking shop of politics. And you know, an active body of politics where people engage daily in politics and develop their political skills and their capacity to be actively engaged in political developments in their society. And, you know, notwithstanding the circumstances that obtained in Grenada, where you probably did need, at that particular historical juncture, a close-knit party, a victim of the Cold War, you know, all the kind of political intrigues and, you know, which exacerbated tensions that already existed. You probably needed a close-knit group of people that, you know, for the sake of security, that could take a certain leadership role, which is not to say that it needed to stop there, though, in terms of your practice or your relationship to the population. And I think Franklin Harvey came to the conclusion that it was going to be difficult, given the lines that they were taking, to strike that balance. So, you know, he kind of quietly, you know, departed from that process. But he was very influential on Morris Bishop, for example. And again, he was the one that they really looked to assume that leadership role. For a number of reasons, his theoretical, you know, understanding and his broad understanding of politics, but also he was not from the cities, from Granville, and I guess some folks within New Drill were wary about having a city-based party where the leadership were mostly from the city, even though you're talking about Grenada, which you have visited, is not, you know, it's not a, but you know, there's that kind of town country dynamic that you find in most places. So, you know, that's just a sort of, that's an example. I mean, much of what eventually constituted the Caribbean left evolved out of protests against what happened to the students at Sir George. In fact, you can almost make the blanket statement that the modern Caribbean left emerged, may have been there in its own latent form, but emerged as a result of what happened at Sir George. Tim Hector, who was a major figure in the Caribbean left, returned to Antigua, and you know, again, out of his experience in Montreal and broadening it beyond Sir George now too, became actively involved in developments in Antigua, Caribbean left. They were amongst the people that, you know, while Cuba was anathema to most people, they would visit Cuba. They obtained scholarships for students across the Caribbean to study in Cuba, him and Rosie Douglas and other people. Now everybody's running to Cuba in the absence of support from the United States to get whatever they can. But in these early days where the governments were looking down upon them, they were arranging these. So there are a number of people that studied medicine and other forms of technical training in Cuba as a result of the work of Rosie and Tim in particular. They were at the forefront of this. So I'm saying, you know, again, these guys, their real political awakening, you know, it evolved here in Montreal. And Montreal played that role. So George was a very important part of it. I think the level of outrage in terms of the Sir George Williams event was exacerbated by the fact that Sir George was supposed to be the People's University. Maybe they would have expected this kind of, you know, this unfortunate, you know, behavior, if you want to put it that, in terms of how the administration responded, in terms of how Perry Anderson himself responded at another university, maybe. But, you know, I think they were, you know, they were, the level of, the extent to which they were incensed, it was exacerbated by the fact that they were at this so-called People's University, and they were being treated like people. So, yeah, you know, there are all kinds of things to look at when it comes to Sir George.
Yeah. I'm wondering if you can talk about something that you mentioned a bit earlier, which was the, I guess, the police response and the administrative mm-hmm. response and the outcome mm-hmm. in terms of the repression that occurred. Mm-hmm. And Sir George.
Yeah, I, well, one thing to remember again is that the police board already had some practice because of the Sir George Williams, not Sir George Williams, sorry, because of the whole situation with the FLQ. In terms of dealing with crises. And they were in a kind of a heightened sense of insecurity as a result of the climate here that existed in Montreal and in Quebec. I should also just add quickly that there were protests happening at McGill University. What's his name? Student leader, very, very active. I mean, he had hundreds, maybe even thousands of people protesting. Part of it, I don't think he was a Francophone himself. Part of it was to make McGill a Francophone university. But there were other demands. So there were, you know, there were major developments at McGill too. And, you know, developments on the university, at University of Montreal, that I can sort of have some vague inkling or, you know, sense that there were things going on there. And so, you know, it, you know, there were things happening in general. So the police were sort of attuned to this kind of thing. In addition to that, sort of lost my train of thought. There was something I was going to say. I mentioned the FLQ, and that they sort of, that was, you know, they had some experience dealing with this. I can't remember what I was going to say. But anyway, there was another point that I went to make. Maybe it will come back to me. But in terms of how the police... Yeah, maybe one of the other things I want to say too is that they were, with the other student protests across North America, there was also this sense that, that, you know, the police had already used repression across North America. I mean, students had been killed or bludgeoned and beaten, bloodied up as a result of the violence of police. Now, when the police decided they were going to break up the occupation, however that decision was made, it seems pretty clear that they were bent on using force, no matter what happened, because they came in riot gear, you know, dressed up like, I mean, from top to bottom with shields and helmets and all of this business. When they entered the room, and Rosie talked about this when he was here, and it's something that I don't think has been emphasized or can be emphasized enough, and you don't have to have absolute proof to be able to raise an issue, you know, and I think it's actually more than conjecture. Coralie Hutchinson, who was one of the students who was involved in the occupation, she may have been from St. Kitts. Apparently there was an incident where she must have called, the officer must have called her name, like Black Bitch or something along those lines. And she called him a pig. And he cracked her on the skull with his baton. And basically cracked her on the skull and cracked her skull. She died within about a year. Something like a brain aneurysm. I'm not sure exactly what it was diagnosed as, but it was a head injury. And I don't know what kind of autopsy was done or not done, but basically, we can sort of conjecture that there was some kind of connection between the two that for some reason was never really explored. I don't know the details as to why it was not explored, but that's a very serious thing that even by way of allusion, I haven't heard many people make mention of. The other development that I was going to mention in terms of the police, you know, we were talking about racism in Canada. The students were separated according to color. I don't know if you've heard about this before, where the black students were put in one cell and the white students were put in another. You know, and again, that it demonstrates, it illustrates the mentality of the police, who, as a reflection, not even just a reflection or a symbol, but as, you know, what's the best way to put it? As gatekeepers of the state, this was their mentality. This was like the way of, you know. So here were these students, many of whom were beaten before they were arrested, and beaten while they were arrested, separated according to color. And it's not surprising that when people were protesting outside the university, you had some, you know, again, a reflection of the society we're living in. I'm just jumping a bit. Some were chanting as, you know, there was a fire in the computer room, and there's been all kinds of discussion or speculation as to who set the fire and whatever. I'm not in a position to say yay or nay concerning that, but you had students outside protesting and demonstrating, "Let the niggas burn." It was a chant, "Let the niggas burn." You know, the other side of that is you had students, black students, white students, and others, you know, protesting in support of the students. You know, but again, it speaks to the dynamics of race in the society that we were living at the time. So you had some black students now walking with placards saying Alabama, an allusion to what was happening in the South, and that Montreal is no different from the South in the United States. Again, jumping just a little bit, one of the things that I know struck Alfie in terms of, you know, because Alfie's a funny person. Because here's Alfie, he's involved in this process. He's working full-time, leaving work, and going straight to Sir George Williams, going home maybe at 5 o'clock in the morning to shower, and then going back to work. He's doing this for days on end. And the day that the police took over the computer room, you know, he had decided to go home a bit early, you know, tired. And he noticed one of the university administrators, Mergler, I think it was, one of them, so around the university, may have consulting with police, and he kind of, something is told him that something might be up, and he said as soon as he put his head on the pillow, he got a call that the police were there and they were about to enter the computer room. But, you know, Alfie is this fascinating character in the sense that he's involved in this thing to the extent that he could be, as not being a student and not being inside the computer room throughout the day because he had a job and his family and his wife and children. He's in it, but he's outside it, assessing it and analyzing it while he's in it, you know, and then able to share reflections with people after the fact. And another thing that struck him organizationally was that one of the, you know, students was sort of involved in Sir George but was studying here. It was part of the whole broad black and West Indian Caribbean community. He lived somewhere close to the university, maybe on St. Matthew or one of those streets there. And Alfie's recollection of what happened after Sir George, after the fire broke out and the police stormed the place, was that black people in particular from the community just came out of nowhere, as he describes it, and lined up. Nobody told them to come to this house of Carl Paris. Alfie and Carl Paris, I think, organized a demonstration. But nobody told them to come to their house and line up to donate money to defend these students. It just happened, you know. It's almost like, you know, it, in the minds of people, given like the continuity of events that had unfolded, it was a logical thing to do. And then again, it sort of reinforced this idea of, like, you know, people's, you know, like, abilities, the whole notion of self-organization, you know, and how under certain things, certain conditions, under certain circumstances, you know, things happen, or people do things, take certain measures, whatever the case may be, that suit the situation. But you can't explain why under other circumstances where the conditions, quote-unquote, appear to be ripe for the same kind of action, it doesn't happen. So that was one of the sort of reflections that that Alfie had of that too, which is again a testament to his, you know, his own, you know, the way he sort of assessed and was always analyzing the world, even when he was in the midst of something. But again, I think it's I was saying earlier that I think you know, events can be trivialized. And, you know, we can scream and shout and say, yes, it was, they occupy the computer room, they, you know, if it's correct, as has been suggested, that they smashed up the computers and set the place on fire, you know, I mean, the smashing of the computers, perhaps, it's possible, given the level of frustration or whatever, but, you know, we were not there. But, you know, the setting of the fire is a bit more questionable when you're inside a place with no, you know, tenable means of escaping, except through the very door where the police are on the other side. That one may be a bit more questionable, but again, it's all speculation one way or the other, we don't know. But all of those things happen, they're events, you know, but it's when we begin to discuss really, like, what do we learn from these things? How does it inform our understanding of social change, the dynamics of social change in particular? How circumstances of diverse kinds converge at a given point in history, at a given point in time, and allow for certain, you know, events to happen that maybe under different circumstances won't happen. These are the things that we can sort of learn, because it helps us to understand when, you know, in terms of the ebb and flow of history, you know, how in periods when there's an ebb, do we sit back and do nothing, or do we begin to create the space and lay the groundwork for bigger developments down the road, which we may not be able to see in terms of exactly what's going to happen, but we know that, you know, there is this ebb of history. You know, it's almost, you know, I don't want to sound like these, you know, kind of anachronistic social scientists, you know, but it's almost scientific. It's one thing you can almost guarantee that they're always, you know, I mean, short of, I'll take out the word guarantee, because we live in a world where we can be annihilated, and when there's none of us around, you know, we're not guaranteed of doing anything. But short of complete annihilation, which is not an impossibility when we consider the world that we're living in, and the mad people that are running it, but it's all the more reason why we need to take the world out of the hands of these people that are running it. But short of that kind of annihilation, history tells us that things come and go, and that there are cycles in life, that things ebb and flow, you know. And, you know, that kind of understanding should be used, I think, to inform how we do our work. So we're not living in the quote-unquote revolutionary period of the 60s and 70s. That period came and went. But we need to understand what precipitated that in some respects, or you know, what kinds of things people were doing that led to that. You know, like, we hear about the Cuban Revolution, just to take an example. Well, it didn't happen in 1959, 1960. There was a series of events that ended, you know, culminated in the Cuban Revolution. It's true of any, things don't just happen because we decide we're going to, occupy a room. Like, things precipitate those kinds of developments, and, things, subsequently follow those kinds of developments. So a revolution or social change, whatever you want to call it, it's not a fixed thing that happens in, a particular point or place at a given time. And then, yes, there's sometimes there are what Hegel described as knots, where, it's almost like, events or social developments, they almost coagulate. And at that critical period, something can turn in one direction or another. But, you can't predict when that's going to come. But you can lay the groundwork to make the best of that period. So even when it seems like we're in a period of retreat and defeat, we always need to be preparing ourselves. I mean, this is how I look at it, that in our mind we're almost saying, well, given the problems that exist, let's just assume for a second, imagine that those problems, you're starting with a clean slate, those problems disappear, George Bush and all the madness that surrounds what is happening right now in the world, or not to fall into that trap of talking about individuals, but even looking at the situation in Canada, and not sort of just looking at Canada as this benign country, the so-called Switzerland of North America, which, given developments in Switzerland and how Switzerland makes its money, is not even a positive statement to begin with anyway. But, if we say, those problems disappear, the question really at the end of the day is, those of us who think or say we're about social change and want to create a better world, what would we do? Or how, more importantly, how would we run this world? How would we run our communities? What kind of relations would we create amongst each other as people? What kind of world would we envision, and how would we bring that world into being? What means? Not just the end. Because the end is saying, well, I would like to see this, but the question is how? What alternatives would we really present that are genuine, viable, real alternatives? So that we're preparing ourselves for not just what is to come, but once we start thinking in terms of how we would do it, we begin to practice how we would do it. And that goes back to James's notion of the party. It's not just because you've assumed power that you begin to engage in real politics or government. It's happening all the time, because we all live in a sphere. The party may be our sphere, and within that party are people involved in the party who live in all kinds of spheres. But I'm saying, we have to cultivate the relationship that make a new society today. And in doing that, you're not preparing for a new society, you're creating it. And it sounds like a nuanced thing, because we're always doing things presumably in order to prepare for the nuanced society. But unless we're attuned to this kind of notion of doing that, there are things that we miss along the way in terms of how we, among ourselves, the kinds of organizations that we build, how we run them, how we function within them, how we relate within whatever units or what we call our community, our spheres of existence, as they call it. We neglect to see those as microcosms of the bigger world that we're trying to create, and that the more of those microcosms are being run, or we're working towards existing in those microcosms, the more that we're doing that, the more of these microcosms are making part of this complex whole that is part of the world. The thing, it amazes me, because it's a very simple notion when you look at it. It only makes sense that if we want to create a world here, which is down the road, that we begin to do it now in the here and now, and not wait till we get there in terms of having the authority or the power to do it, to begin to think about how we're actually going to manage it. It only makes sense. People in the business world understand that. You can, somebody who is successful financially under capitalism is somebody that knows how to plan and think ahead and is a step ahead of other people in this game. If these folks are able to do that, for selfish interests, how is it that we've become so neglectful of this question of organization you know, back in the whole Cold War days, if you're, you know, like everything was a question or a position, the question of organization or the position of, but I'm saying, like, these things were made into fetishes. And then, like, it was, you know, I mean, I'm saying we, because, like, you know, we're products of the Cold War in our own ways, too. You know, we evolved to a certain extent in that environment. Well, not to a certain, we did, you know, in one way or the other. But then, like, the relationships behind these questions were lost. You know, made into a kind of science out there somewhere that's abstracted from people. But, like, we work at a radio station, whether you work in a telemarketing company, whether you work in a community organization, whether you work in, every one of those places is a site for social change because you're interacting with people. If we forget that change is about people, then, you know, the game is lost before we started. So, but to me, you know, I'm saying that to say because it happens to be how I see the world. But it's also, you know, these are the kinds of lessons or examples that we should seek to draw upon when we look at events like Sir George Williams or when we look broadly speaking about what happened in the 60s in the, you know, throughout the world, when we seek to understand why this happened. You know, we may not be able to obtain a broad, sweeping understanding of why the 60s. But if we look at each one of these movements, we can study where they were successful. We need to talk about, like, shortcomings and so on, but where they were successful, and also where there were, you know, where there were failures, and we learn from those strengths and those weaknesses. And to the extent that things are successful, I think we'll always find, it depends on our measure of success too, that, you know, it wasn't, yes, there's a degree, there's spontaneity, you know, and like spontaneity, you know, has, you know, the degrees of spontaneity. The mere fact that somebody decides to form a group called the Conference Committee, the Johnson Forest Tendency, the International African Service Bureau, somebody had an idea, it came from somewhere. That's somewhat spontaneous. And people spontaneously decide to get involved because somebody can ask and you can say yes, you can say no. So there are degrees of spontaneity. So like James' notion of spontaneity and so forth, it's not just like this kind of, you know, slipshod approach where, you know, I mean, there's an element of that. Because like there's action and reaction involved and, you know, like we can't account for why we do everything. So that's spontaneous. But like there's a, you know, there's a large degree to make something coherent, there's a large degree of organization too. So we shouldn't run away from the whole notion of organization. I think James has been misunderstood in that way too, when he started calling him a mystic and so on. I mean, you have a party or a kind of unwieldy, you know, group of, you know, tens of thousands of people that kind of, you know, that make up a party. That doesn't make any sense. Never mind millions of people. But no, there's organization involved. The factory workers in Gdansk, they organize themselves. Self-organization, somewhat spontaneous, but there was organization. They elected their factory leaders. You know, I mean, they were, you know, this is what solidarity evolved into. You know, it could be a whole other discussion on what happened to solidarity after it reached a certain point. But, you know, so all of these questions are there in micro, in all the work that we do. Student organizations and you know, and I think those are the things that I, you know, the dynamics of social change are the kinds of things that we should try and cull from those experiences. And, you know, beyond, you know, after we get over the initial sort of excitement of discovering that, like, you know, these students did this and they did that, all that is important because it showed that people had a degree of independent thinking and, you know, they were willing to take certain actions and take response for them. And all of that is important. They didn't just sit down and wait for things to unfold. They actively participated. But the story is much bigger than that. One other thing in terms of lessons from Sir George, like, that I found it very interesting that Alfie would say this too, is that he realized from watching developments within the FLQ later and like reflecting on what happened to Sir George, is that you occupy the computer room, or, and I'm not equating the two, and I don't think he was in the literal sense, or in the case of the FOQ, you kidnap some people, and then depending on how the public or the government or the university administration in this case responds to what you have done, the question becomes then what? You know, and a parallel is coming to my mind as we speak right now, and again, it goes back to what do you do and how do you do it? After a couple of days, the enthusiasm in any kind of occupation can begin to wane. So people were happy to leave the computer when it appeared as though a settlement had been reached. And then there was a breach in confidence, because when it appeared there was a settlement, the students let down their guard, and then the police came in, which added to the level, you know, the degree to which the students were incensed when they realized that they'd been, in some respects, tricked. But really, had the university decided to respond differently, even initially, in terms of pretending or suggesting that there was an agreement reached. Suppose there was no agreement, and the students were aware that there was no agreement. What would have been the next stage? Either they have to stay there indefinitely, until the police come in eventually, if they do, or they give up. Something would have had to happen. You know, and I'm not saying, you know, what was right, what was wrong, but then it's just, you know, these are things that you have to kind of factor in when you take action of a certain kind. Related to what happened in Sir George, and Sir George precipitating this event, as I mentioned earlier, when these bodies of people, Geddes Granger and what's the name of the organization that he was leading, and the oil field workers were involved, and so on. After a while, they were having protests, they were mobilizing large sectors of the population, Indian and African, as I was saying earlier. You know, after a while, they were going in circles. There was one protest after another. After they didn't know what else to do. And it came to the point, and I didn't go into all the details of this, but it came to the point where the army, a section of the army was in support. This is like real revolution we're talking about, in support of these developments, and would not have come out against the people. Eric Williams had a helicopter waiting. You know, so this was like developments, like this is like the seizure of power, call it that. Whether you call it cold feet or whatever the case may be, those protests were not willing, and I'm not saying whether they should have or shouldn't be, but I'm saying according to the steps that they were taking, it was going in some kind of quote-unquote logical direction. But the process didn't unfold that way because, you know, I don't think a lot of thought, it doesn't appear as though a lot of thought had been input to what next after we mobilize the people, after one rally and then another rally and then another rally. You know, where are you going? Because if they were explicitly telling the people to take power, it's pretty clear that would have happened given the level of mobilization. But then, were people prepared to take power? And what would they have done with it after? We've seen what's happened in many parts of Latin America, the Caribbean, many parts of the Third World, when a lot of thought and exercise is not put into that question. The army was there. When nothing was really happening, they went back to the army barracks. The Americans had their ships out there, but then again, that was another thing that had to be factored in. You know, what was the climate conducive to that kind of, you know, overthrow of power? Venezuelan army was on standby too. And then, as I said, it's been suggested that there were Canadian troops somewhere around who would have intervened perhaps too. So there were all of these questions in terms of what next and how, which oftentimes in terms of political developments, and, you know, I'm very reluctant to say this because I'm on the periphery of even recent developments here in Montreal, but there may be an element of that among some of the students at Concordia in terms of recent developments at the university, in terms of being very clear on what the objectives are before you sort of get caught up in the whirlwind of the climate and where that can take you, because it has a momentum of its own. What happened in Grenada, you know, you compare what happened to Grenada in 79 and you compare with what happened in Trinidad in 1970. You have a group of people that were facing, I mean, different circumstances, albeit, where they sort of had to make a choice. And, you know, as I mentioned, Franklin Harvey, for one, you know, decided that there should have been a process of a certain kind. And some may argue that the level of repression as I had suggested earlier, may have called for this kind of close-knit party, which evolved into what was a central committee on so-called Marxist-Leninist lines. But then another argument could be made that had this work of another kind had it continued in terms of working directly with the population, it perhaps in the short term would have seemed less of a threat, and a certain level of development and evolution in terms of the population's capacities to be engaged in the political process would have developed to a point where it couldn't be stifled. So even though there was mass support, you can't say there was mass involvement in the seizure of power. And that influenced how the events unfolded in Grenada throughout the revolution. And the population was never able to catch up to where the leadership was. But I'm saying all of these are factors that, you know, weigh heavily on, or should weigh heavily in terms of presaging what possibly may happen or envisioning the kind of society and how you want to get there. All of these things are factors, I think, that are, you know, and I want to be careful too, because I don't want to sit here like a critic, but let's say that we can benefit in hindsight from the experiences of people before. So I'm not saying they should have, I mean, we can sit here and do that now. But I'm saying at some point, I remember once having a discussion with the mother of a friend, a close friend of mine, and we were talking about something, and I think I'm being smart or whatever. But anyway, she said something about history, sort of, well, you know, well, that's what history tells us anyway. That's the way things are, nothing will change. And I kind of quip, well, you know, I mean, I meant what I said, and I believe that strongly. I'm probably referring more to the way I said it, but so like, I kind of quip, well, you know, the point is to change history by learning from it. So it's not necessarily because under certain circumstances this is what happened, under similar circumstances it has to happen again. If we learn from the experience of history, we don't have to repeat, you know, it's a cliche that history repeats itself if you carry that too far. You know, we're in a position to learn, you know, from and you know, from other people's experience, from past experience. But despite the gloom and doom and the real dark, that's not the best way to put it, the cloud that is hovering over our heads in terms of the global climate right now. Because it's a nasty situation we have in this world, where we have this, you know, this just genuine attempt. And, you know, it's funny, all of last year I was saying I need to sit down and read about the Roman Empire. And I finally got my hand on Gibbon's book, The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, and I read it a couple of months back. But this was post September 11th. When once you hear axis of evil and this, that, the other too, there's a certain ring to that language, which began with New World Order in the 90s. We had a bit of a pause, at least in terms of the verbiage, but we come back to that now with Bush Jr., you know, picking up where his father left off. I said, like, there's something happening here. And there's something too, you know, there's a different kind of ring. And what I've noticed now, especially this year, is that the word empire is being bandied around a lot, you know. And obviously there's a lot of legitimacy to it. It may be being bandied around so much that nobody's taking it as seriously as it should, because this is real. But my point is that even with this cloud hovering above us, and, you know, the general climate of doom and gloom, we're in a very unique position, not only to learn from history, because we're living, you know, and then the next generation after us is going to be able to say the same thing, but we're living now, we're alive. So we can look at thousands of years of history if we want to, and learn from that experience. Apparently Rumsfeld, when he came into office in 2000, commissioned a study on the history of empires. I don't know if you've heard about that. And I can't find a study anywhere, but I've seen allusions to it in many articles on the internet, in New York Times, this, that, the other. He wanted to understand the history of empires and how they maintained and sustained their power. Interestingly enough, it doesn't appear as though they were interested in why those empires fell, as they all have. But of course, that doesn't fit with the game plan. You don't expect to fall until you fall. Short-sighted, but, you know, I mean, everything that we see happening, it smacks of short-sightedness, so it's not surprising. But it says that they actually came into power thinking consciously about this notion of empire. and September 11th was a catalyst for it. Now, that's fine, and we have people like Noam Chomsky and others, we have all kinds of people talking about this publicly now. But, like, we need to talk about what kind of society. We need to present an alternative. And I'm almost saying now that every time we have a public comment, and I'm exaggerating a bit, we need to begin to talk about how we change this thing, how we begin to envision something different. Because even those people on the left, with all the best intentions, by reinforcing how powerful this thing is and how powerful these folks are, they're reinforcing the idea that it cannot be changed when we only focus on what is wrong with the world. And not only do we have, and this is the point I want to make, not only do we have the benefit of thousands of years of history, but even in terms of recent history, we're living in a post-Cold War climate, and we can't underestimate what that means. You look at the whole left in the Caribbean, if I'm talking about like the immediate experience and tradition that I see myself coming out of, and that has influenced me, and in Africa, in the broad Pan-African tradition, which is also what has influenced me a great deal, or the study of Russian history, but American history, and how the Cold War influenced developments in all of these societies. You know, even when people thought they were removed from it by critiquing it, they were, to their detriment, influenced by it. Their critiques were influenced by it, the tone and nature of their critiques. It was all in relation to what was happening in a Cold War climate. I mean, Jamaican politics was severely, severely influenced. And that's a whole, I mean, hundreds of people have died because of the Cold War in Jamaica. We had elections in which, you know, one party, semi-socialist, another party funded by the United, supported by the United States. In an election we had, you know, an election year 1976, more 1980, you know, hundreds of people killed as a result of this whole Cold War disaster. But like, we live in a world where psychologically we're actually able to, without having to go through all kinds of mental gymnastics, to think in a more freer and open way. You know, because even those James, for example, Marxist extraordinaire, one of the great thinkers of the last century and of our era, even his notion of Marxism is tinged by kind of anti-communist, you know, I mean, anti-Soviet Union. I say bias for lack of a better word, you know, which meant, A, James was not able to acknowledge, even when it was for selfish reasons, that the Soviet Union played a very important role in anti-colonial developments throughout the world, and the significance of that alternative, as much as emphasizing all the problems with that alternative as an alternative in quotes, and his critique of it and his argument that it was not a real alternative. All of that, you know, I happen to share much of what James believed, but I'm saying it was almost dishonest. And we see that in hindsight now, when we see we have this one superpower, which is not literally true, I would have to say too. Because I don't know how anybody can say the Soviet Union is, I mean, not the Soviet Union, that Russia is not a superpower. In this world, when you have a few nuclear weapons, you can be a superpower. Because it doesn't take millions of weapons to destroy the world. And beyond the Soviet Union, what I find even more ridiculous is that just because China is not pronouncing on the world stage, how can anybody think that China is not a superpower? They send people to the moon. They have nuclear weapons. They have a population of over a billion people, which is more people than even if you extend this notion of empire to include those countries that come under the jurisdiction of the United States. They don't control that many people. How is China not a superpower? India, in my mind, is somewhat of a superpower. You see, this is the world that we're living in. So all of that is to say that, you know, we can benefit from a lot of hindsight. Post-Cold War hindsight, we can benefit from centuries of history, decades of history, millennia of history. We're in a privileged position to, you know, learn from the mistakes of people that have come before us, whether it's in the university setting, local community setting, internationally, nationally, and really think, if we invested maybe a quarter a tenth of the amount of time we invest in critiquing. I'm talking about folks on the left now, because it makes sense to be on the point to critique anybody outside the left, because it's the same critique. They have to go. What do we change it with? If we spend even a tenth of the amount of time that we spend critiquing the forces that be, the powers that be, and focusing some of that energy on auto-critiques of ourselves, but also, I think, critiques of... not critiques. Genuinely studying and exercising alternatives to the current situation. I think we would advance in ways that... that could be quite surprising, because within the framework, and I'm not making an argument for the system as it is, I think everything I said should suggest that you know, there's a degree of agency, and there are possibilities that we ourselves do not seize, because we don't take the time to assess things where they are and grab those, take advantage of openings that may be right under our very nose.
Can I ask you for some impressions or remarks on what you think of the importance or relevance of the Palestinian struggle right now as it exists on a world level, but also in terms of how it relates to political activity mm-hmm. at Concordia University and in Montreal mm-hmm. in general?
First of all, I would be very careful and start by saying that we all have different levels or different degrees of stake in the situation in the Middle East. As human beings, we should all be concerned about the plight of Palestinians. And much the same way the anti-apartheid struggle was a rallying point against injustice in general, I think the cause, the plight of Palestinians is the same. And there are all kinds of other parallels that can be drawn between the relationship between Israel, Palestine, and the government of South Africa and South Africans, from the way people live, which are basically Bantustans in the West Bank and Gaza, in Palestine in general. The settler mentality, you know, no matter how far it goes back, you know, there's a particular... We had a long conversation here in our study group at the Institute about that the other day. In the difference between the kind of like settler colonies and other forms of colonialism, and the pernicious nature of settler colonies, the Portuguese colonies, Algeria as a French colony, and so on, Zimbabwe. So, like, there's a symbolic thing in terms of like Palestinians struggling for freedom as that being a symbolic manifestation of our generic struggles for more humane world. But at the end of the day, the struggle in that section of the world is far more symbolic. It's far from being symbolic for the people that are living it. And I think we have to be very careful. And, you know, this obviously goes for the average person. But also, I think it's true of people who may be from that region but live outside the situation. Because there are also people, I've heard Palestinians of all kinds talk about the situation, and sometimes the kinds of things that are being suggested are things that somebody can only say when they're removed. And sometimes being removed is important because you can step back and try and attempt to see things globally. But then, you know, I was listening to some folks criticizing like the suicide bombings and so on. Now, nobody in their right mind, this is my personal opinion, can make a blanket, I support suicide bombings. What's there to support in suicide bombings? But then, it's not a question of whether you support it or not. It's a manifestation of something. And you know, we need to understand, you know, how and why things develop in society. Fanon, you know, in The Wretched of Earth, talks about the phenomenon of violence, and people have called him an apostle of violence. But he's explaining why violence... You know, violence doesn't just come out of thin air. When people, certain kinds of violence, people are confronted with certain circumstances or live under certain conditions. And the situation of Palestinians, I mean, indices, I mean, if Palestine were an independent country, which it's supposed to be, the conditions under which Palestinians are living are, would be amongst the worst anywhere in the world. That is real. So when somebody commits suicide, it's because they believe they have nothing to lose. And Palestinians have lost everything. So to a Palestinian, what is their life? You know, what is giving their life as part of the struggle? It's what is that when you've lost everything? And so for people from the outside to look at it and say, well, suicide bombing, terrorism, and to just sort of take that at face value and say, well, that is madness. A, they're missing something. And secondly, obviously, they're ignoring, you know, because like terrorism is a word that's being bandied around. But what about this thing? We need to go back and, you know, like people bandy around the word democracy. So because you have elections, you're democratic. Because you have an independent country or a state, you're not capable of committing terrorism. What is it that the state of Israel does? What has been happening, you know, is not the situation of Palestinians one under which they've been living under terror? So when you think about these things, you know, like, you know, we have to get beyond individual leaders, whether it's Arafat, Sharon, because it's beyond that. Like, there's a concrete situation there. And I think, you know, I don't want to, you know, iterate a cliche that only the people in those regions, you know, that's literally true to a certain extent. It's true. But we also know that the anti-apartheid, if we learn from the anti-apartheid struggle, which I, you know, was sort of involved in on the tail end, international pressure means something. International solidarity means something. And at certain critical junctures in history, it can mean a tremendous amount. So nobody can take away from the fact that the struggle to end apartheid was fought by South Africans, and they bore the brunt of that struggle. But we know that international solidarity played a tremendous role and contributed to that struggle too. We know that. So I'm just saying that, you know, as somebody from the outside, I'm very cautious of what I say. And what I'm saying here, you know, given the opportunity to say it publicly, I would say it too. But I'm saying I wouldn't consider it my place, you know, when there are people who are more intimately involved in the situation, actively involved in the situation, and have more directly at stake in that situation, who are far more capable of addressing and talking about that issue to raise it. So I don't, you know, so I'm saying we all have a responsibility, yes, obviously, and we shouldn't shy away from that. But we also need to be responsible, because it's easy for us to say things outside that, you know, like we have nothing to lose to a certain extent. We all do in a certain way, but to a certain extent we don't. So I just kind of wanted to put that that way, because it also, you know, it relates to perhaps some of the criticisms which I can, you know, I've heard from a distance in terms of criticism that people make, students of Concordia, this, that, the other, and all of this other stuff. Now, I just made an argument for international solidarity, and I take nothing away from that whatsoever. What I do want to say, and it goes back to the whole Sir George Williams thing again, is I think sometimes you have to sit down and assess what is the most effective means of communicating what you want to communicate at a given point in time and it being heard. And in relation to that, what is my role as an individual? It could be as a student, and in a specific sense, we're speaking as a student organization. And I'm going to suggest that those students, and you're also somebody that's been actively a part of this, but I'm speaking more recently, have put themselves on the line in ways that I think many of them aren't even aware of. And that says it's a testament to people's level of commitment, that you can sort of jump into uncharted territory and put your neck on the cutting block because you believe in something, you know, even without being intimately involved in the issue, but because you see that something is inherently wrong and needs to be addressed. So that's one point I want to make. related to that point, I want to say that to a certain extent, it can be irresponsible. And I don't like that word, it's not the best word, but it's just the word that comes to mind right now. To put your head on the chopping block without having benefited from the history of those who were involved in similar kinds of events and understanding the circumstances that surrounded those events and drawing lessons from those events. So I'm speaking about Sir George Williams, and it could be any other event. I'm speaking about Sir George because it's the same institution, same university, it's students. And what do I mean by that? Well, many things. It means understanding... there's two things I want to say. One is understanding when to be hard or when to be soft. As Marx described it in the 18th premiere of Louis Bonaparte, when to be coarse and when to be fine. There are times when, whether it be propaganda, you want to call it, agitation, mobilization, demonstration, and protests, they are a very, very, very important means to an end. And even when they're not, you know, like the optimal means to an end, they also play an important role. But then you also have to assess what resources you have at your disposal, A, in terms of the impact of the situation, if you're talking about the situation in the Middle East from a distance, and then B, what resources do you have that can really work towards educating the population that you're quote-unquote serving, the student population, influencing the way they think, not just about the situation in the Middle East, but about injustice in general. And I think the students, from what I've seen, have actively sought to do that. What I'm suggesting is that sometimes there's an emphasis on quantity, in terms of the number of people you can mobilize or get to a demonstration or to a speaking engagement, as opposed to quality. I'm not making this stark contrast between Dubai. I'm just, for argument's sake, I'm using the language I have in my head at the moment. In terms of the kind of work, what I saw some of the students try to do with Facing Reality, where, you kind of try and get beyond the immediate and look at these issues in terms of their broad implications. And the implications for these, the significance of the issues that you're addressing immediately in the wider society, what we can learn or how these issues can be broached in a wider society, also making connections between what students are doing as students and what's happening in the wider society, also thinking beyond your tenure as a student and how the skills that you've acquired and gained, and also the vision that you're trying to present, how that can be used in a community that extends beyond the university, because the university is there after you go 4 years, 3 years. And they always have this mentality in their mind. And even those, who we may consider opponents, like the dean or whoever, even if that person goes, they know that there's a whole administration and bureaucracy that's going to remain there. So their thinking is very different from a student. But I'm saying that students have to be able to do things. They have to think two things. One is to be able to extend their thinking beyond the university even while they're in it, and think about what they're going to do while they're in the university. I mean, while they're no longer in the university, in the wider community, or even making the transition to the community while they're in it. It was easier for us, some of us, to do it while we are students at McGill, as part of the Black Students Network. Even part of McGill did to a certain extent, but particularly part of the Black Students Network, because there was a wider Black community that we sort of ourselves generically part of, and were part of. But the other thing is also, which I think, to a certain extent, from what I've seen, again, on the periphery, the students at Concordia have been able to do in some areas and less in others, is create institutions or framework or mechanisms that allow the work to continue. Maybe where that area has been strong, and again, I'm saying, and even reluctantly from a distance, with things like the People's Potato and, getting institutions like Marriott's out of the university, people can have healthy food at affordable or cost-free, that's affordable or even cost-free. Things that just cannot be changed just like that. They become almost institutionalized, and then students see themselves as having the interest in continuing those things. But then where I'm saying there may be somewhat of a weakness, and it's not just true of aspect, you know, it's usually true of student organizations, is thinking a year in advance in other areas, particularly in terms of politics, because there are certain decisions which may be correct ethically and politically, but depending on how those decisions are carried out, they probably ensure that you don't get elected the next year, because students are students. Students are often fickle. At the end of the day, most students, including those that consider themselves radical in some form or another, want to buckle up and get on with their lives, which is what happens with most. It's usually a small number of that core that's involved actively in political, whatever kind of developments on the campus, that continue throughout their life. And not understanding that can be a real shortcoming, because when you don't factor that in, you end up living for the now. And when your tenure is gone, and it could be a tenure of 3 years or four, if those who follow don't share the same vision. I'm saying this is easier said than done, because it's easy to say this, you know, but I'm not saying that this is what we did when I was a student. I'm just saying it's easy to look at it, you know, in hindsight. You know, what I see with this is CSU has a lot of resources and has for very particular reasons that I don't completely understand, has a degree of independence that I don't know of any other student union that I've known of having, which comes with all kinds of benefits and responsibilities, but understanding that we live in a climate in which the institution is probably capable, or you could probably attest to the fact that they are capable and have done to you of using illegal means to eradicate what has been a hard-won gain. And this goes back again to understanding when to be coarse and when to be fine without giving up your convictions, but understanding the climate and what works now may not work tomorrow and vice versa. And understanding what these folks are capable of doing in a kind of climate, post-September 11th climate, but, you know, it was coming. The climate was shifting that direction. September 11th is being used as a pretext. What do I mean by that again? It's like, for example, go back to Sir George, post-Sir George, Rosie Douglas. He's released from prison. He spent about 18, 19 months, something close to that. Still actively involved. A fellow named Warren Hart becomes his bodyguard, driving him around, across to Ganawagi or Ganasetagi, and Ganawagi mostly, and, you know, having meetings and so on. This guy's like his bodyguard and his driver. You know, I guess maybe people were less vigilant at that time, but they also could have learned from, like, the 30s and 40s and what happened to people that were considered communists and so on. Even under the Du Plessis regime here, you know, where anti-communist sentiment, you know, then became anti-black powers and anti-student, I mean, whatever you call it. But there are always lessons that you can learn from what happened before. You know, perhaps Rosie should have known to be more careful, because it turned out this guy was a CIA, FBI agent who apparently had possibly been involved in the murder of Fred Hampton, a leading Black Panther figure in Chicago. This is serious stuff. This guy was encouraging him to get arms, to pick up. This was in the Gazette. I'm not saying anything. You know, it was revealed in the Gazette after, in 1976, I think it was. Encouraging people to pick up arms. Wanted to show people how to explode bombs. Picked up Angela Davis from the airport and was trying to, you know, encourage her to, you know, incite some kind of, you know, violent outbreak, or you want to know where you can get guns. You know, this kind of thing. And of course, he would disappear. If, you know, assuming he's successful, which he was not. And these people have guns and bombs in their possession. They're arrested, rounded up, and that's the end of it. So we have to understand that this is Canadian history. It's not American FBI. It's not a movie. This is what these people are capable of doing. So you may even decide to organize a peaceful protest. But then you balance all the factors, whatever a peaceful protest means. And say, should we organize this thing knowing very well that they may put in people that will break windows, that will do this, that will do that. And those folks will not be the ones that are arrested, but it'll be used as a pretext to arrest anybody that's present. So then you kind of calculate these factors, and you may decide to have the demonstration, maybe not. But what I'm saying is that I don't think somebody should go into something not consciously thinking about those things. You make whatever decision you think is best, having thought through those factors, but like, there's too much history out there not to sort of, you know, be apprised of it. That's basically the point that I'm making, because, you know, I was just talking to somebody yesterday, actually, and he was telling me that, and this, it's going to come out in the media soon if it hasn't come out already. For 20 years, the head of security in the IRA, it's going to come out in the paper soon, it's been maybe in the British media already, head of security in the IRA, turns out the person was an agent. Look, if that could go undetected in the IRA, I mean, a student organization, no big deal. No big deal whatsoever. But the thing is, the stakes are higher now, just as they were in the 60s. They didn't arrest students because they thought they were arresting students, they would have let them go or dealt with them differently. They imprisoned some of them. The students at Concordia, anybody for that matter, engage in a certain kind of protest. They have to realize they're not seen as students. They're being perceived as enemies of the state, and the state is acting accordingly. Now, I don't think that should change. I mean, we need to change this world. And it's, you know, as broad and big as that sounds, that's literally true. So it doesn't mean that we're not supposed to, people are not supposed to act. But people should be conscious of what's out there and what is possible. And I'm not convinced that everybody, some more conscious than others, yes, but everybody's been conscious of that. And that's why I'm saying, you know, that's another, you know, it's, you know, again, it's an argument in terms of being able to learn from history and not think that everything that we do is new, that we're reinventing the wheel, you know, without adding anything necessary that's unique and original. That's the point that I wanted to make in terms of that. And it's also the point that, you know, when I mentioned Du Plessis just a second ago, it's the point when I lost my train of thought earlier, that was the point I wanted to make. That was part of the climate that, you know, they were just in the post-Du Plessis climate when people like Alfie and others came here. And, you know, so there was a sense of possibility, possibly even with a liberal government, on a liberal government on a provincial level, but also, you know, the regime, it was almost like a regime change, you know, to use this funny language of today, in terms of Du Plessis, who sort of basically helped keep Quebec in the Dark Ages. You know, he was removed out of power, and this guy was anti-communist. They had the padlock laws where they would lock down any organization that was deemed communist, which was an excuse to lock down any opposition. You know, he can, you know, colluded with the Catholic Church pretty much to keep people backward and ignorant. You know, and obviously they had a, you know, it was just something that people should talk about more when they talk about oppression here in Quebec historically. You know, one of the major reasons why the British, or Anglophones I should say, were able to get ahead economically and politically is because the Catholic Church, I'm saying this like, you know, because most Anglophones are not Catholic, played a major role in keeping its own population backward. So that's part of the picture too that people sort of neglect. And you know, so all of these things were part of what influenced the climate here in Montreal and here in Quebec too.
Dave, I want to thank you for your time and for the number of questions that you've answered and the thoroughness with which you've answered them. But I have a number of, I guess, really short, specific questions that are coming out of stuff that is not a criticism in terms of your responses. I think it's very valuable. But just let me ask you some really specific questions that I'm wondering if you could touch on. You mentioned how the students were segregated after they were arrested in terms of the different cells that they were put in. Was the occupation itself an integrated movement with white and black students together, or were white and black students occupying different parts of the building? That's one question. And question two is, when the state came to handing out repression, did they treat the white students differently than the black students in regards to the amount of jail time or whether they were found guilty or innocent?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll try to be short. And the short answer is that it's very difficult to me. You know, as you asked me that question, actually, what occurred to me is that, time permitting, I think it would be good for you to speak to people that were actually actively involved in the Sir George. You know, there are a few that are maybe around. If they're willing, it would be worthwhile, I think. Because like, there are internal things that, you know, these are not the things that people necessarily write about and so on, but they're all part of what makes up a, you know, a movement or an event or that kind of thing. I, you know, speaking very generally, you know, I think it would be neglectful to suggest that it was completely integrated in terms of there not being whatever kinds of tensions or differences amongst different groups. And I'm saying it that way because even though you asked me the question in terms of race, there were ideological differences amongst the students. The truth of the matter is that not everybody supported Rosie in his role as the spokesperson. Not everybody, but that's normal. And even though we're talking about the black community, the Caribbean community, not everybody, for example, you know, and I've seen this in subsequent interviews where people talked about that, felt that people who are not students should have been involved. And these are people that were also some of the complainants saying some of them. So that there were ideological differences, you know, some sort of this is our community. And I think probably most people saw it that way, but there are also people that didn't, and saw it as completely apolitical. So it only stands to reason that under the, in a climate of black power, some would have also resented the presence of white students there, and some wouldn't have. So, you know, that's the best way I could say I would put it. You know, that's the best way I could say I could put it. So it wasn't black. You know, it's gonna sound funny. It wasn't black or white. You know, it was a bit of this and a bit of that in terms of people. That's how I've come to understand it. That's one thing in terms of how the police treated. I mean, I think it was pretty clear that, you know, and I can't give you details on this, that the police treated the different students separately. Because at the end of the day, you know, I mean, this is not, I'm speaking figuratively because probably most of the police officers were francophone, but figuratively speaking, you know, the white students could have been their sons and daughters. And, you know, given the racism and racial sensibilities of the time, you know, it shouldn't surprise us at all that, I mean, surprising and not surprising that they were separated. But one story I know of, and I can't remember which of the students it was, but upon being released, the student was driven way out somewhere, I think on the South Shore. And, like, it's not the South Shore as we understand today, where, like, lots of traffic, public transportation, and in the middle of winter. And almost left to freeze to death, told to walk home. I've never heard of like comparable incidents in terms of white students. You know, it's possible that some of the white students were beaten too. I know that many of the black students were beaten. So, yeah, I mean, that's the general way I can answer the question. Somebody actively involved in the incident could,
Do you know if any white students served jail terms?
Not that I know of, but I wouldn't quote me on that as that being definitive. Yeah.
Do you know what the position was of white student institutions, be they the student union associations of the campus or the student newspaper?
With the exception of the Georgian, I couldn't answer that question in any detail. And I know that the Georgian, which was the school newspaper, the major school newspaper on the university at the time, turned over a special issue. I don't know if you've seen that, but turned over a special issue of the Georgian to the students. And in other respects were quite supportive in terms of, you know, even leading up to the event, I've seen old issues of Concordia, the Georgian, also McGill Daily too, but they were covering the occupation, covering the complaints before the occupation, and the occupation and events that, you know, like the police breakup of the occupation and also events following the end of the occupation.
There's something that I found interesting in a documentary that I saw about the events, and that was that at one point the university rector had an RCMP detail to protect him because allegedly there were members of the Black Panther Party or the Black Liberation Army that were supposedly about to take a hit out on him. And you did mention that that Bobby Seale was present for a conference,
the Hemispheric Conference
against the Vietnam War. Are you aware of more specific links between the Black Panthers and
Aldrich Cleaver was supposed to come to a conference at the Congress of Black Writers. In fact, he was actually listed as among the speakers, but he was not. I don't think he was even able to leave California. He was on some kind of probation, almost like house arrest. So he was supposed to come, wasn't able to make it. But I remember Stokely Carmichael, who was able to come, had this kind of international stature as the leader of the Black Power movement, so to speak, and was also associated with the Black Panther Party. And he had been here before, in 67, and spoke at Sir George, probably in some of the old issues of the Georgian. I would be shocked if there wasn't some coverage of the talks or events, you know, that he was involved in. And Rosie was quite close with Stokely, from what I see and understand, and remained so, actually. This was they were quite close years after, coming into the 90s, before Stokely passed away. And it dates back to today's here in Montreal. You know, Stokely lived in Guinea, in West Africa. But his party, the All African People's Revolutionary Party, Rosie sort of worked as an informal diplomat for the Mataba, which is a kind of international body of the Libyan government. Rosie was very much involved in that. It's said that, among other things, he helped negotiate the Libyans supporting the ANC in their struggle against apartheid at a very critical point. So, but Stokely had this relationship with the Mataba also. So this is just to give you an idea of like that relationship was fostered. You asked me about links between the Black Panther Party, but this whole notion of like what's his name, the rector, whoever it was, this whole idea of somebody, you know, it sounds kind of fanciful to me, but
it's kind of similar to the comments made by the rector of today at Concordia, Frederick Lowy, talking about students at Concordia that may or may not be supportive of Hamas. Or of comments relating to the CSU handbook being a guide for the youth wing of Osama bin Laden's organizations. I'm wondering if you could also, if you have any information in terms of if numbers of students that were involved in this movement were ended up joining specific revolutionary parties or organizations, like. Were there Maoist or Trotskyist or communist groups around at the time that tried to politically intervene in the struggle, or that had?
I've heard that and read that several places. I think even in the book that Dennis Forsyth edited, there were some allusions to that too. But I couldn't say that for sure. It wouldn't surprise me on the one hand, but then I mean. What do you really say about it on the other? And the reason why I say it wouldn't surprise me, because you mentioned Maoist and Trotskyist. Now, I have less experience with Maoist organizations, but I know of an incident, and I hope I'm not making a mistake in saying it was a Maoist organization in which, and this is something that Alfie recounted to me, in which over a very simple discussion, I think it was about the situation in Cuba, in one of the bookstores that used to exist downtown before the collapse of the Soviet Union, all these kind of like communists and Maoists and some books all sort of went by the wayside. That over a discussion like that, the owner or proprietor of the bookstore pulled out a pickaxe or a hammer, you know, coming towards Alfie. Now, I'm saying that to say that, you know, there's always been this kind of like, you know, it's like reflecting on the Cold War and the kind of funny tensions and like the how like disagreements were over things that when you look at it in hindsight, it was, you know, this is what, you know, major factions were. It seems ridiculous in hindsight. But then certain groups have also had, you know, speaking of the Trotskyists, which I have more experience with, I think, going back to days when I was in high school myself, you know, I have noticed, you know, there's this kind of tendency to, at times, be involved or get involved in the struggles of different groups without fully understanding and even respecting the integrity of those groups as having inherent value on their own and almost wanting to lead them. That's my long way of saying that, you know, in terms of like the 60s, anything is possible. And I'm not saying it will either be good or bad. I've heard people describe it in derisive ways, or read, you know, that, you know, not in necessarily positive terms. And also that the press of that time, if you read some of the press clippings, they use that to suggest that these people, like the entire body of students, were Maoists and following the Red Book and that kind of thing. So I don't know to what extent, that's my long way. I don't know specifically to what extent other kinds of groups were involved, or whether it would be a positive or negative influence. But I can say, though, that in terms of the direction that the students took, particularly the students, the black students, it was an independent position that was predicated upon, you know, them being incensed by the level of disrespect that the institutions demonstrated towards them, by the kind of malignant but quiet racism that people experience in the society, of which, you know, the administration's response was in micro form a manifestation of. I mean, because some of these students, they came here, they'll tell you stories about, like, they would sit behind a white, this is Montreal, not Alabama, and they'd sit beside a white person on the bus, and people would get up. And, you know, but when you're not conscious of certain norms, you sort of push the barriers, you know, and then sometimes maybe you become conscious of them and you push them anyway. So, like, these folks helped change the climate by their actions, but it wasn't easy. You know, when you have a few West Indian students, and like, it's cool, so you do your calypso, you do a little limbo at a cultural event on the university campus, that's cool. But students were coming in droves, you know. And as Richard Small said when he, Richard Small is from Jamaica, but was close to C.L.R. James when he was studying in England in the 60s. He's a famous lawyer from Jamaica, actually. And he said in his speech at the Congress of Black Writers, talking about how the character of Britain had changed after the Second World War because of the influx of West Indians. He said, well, you know, there was something about the character of Britain that needed to change. It needed to, and that's what happened. You know, but the same can be said of, you know, what was happening here in Montreal. There was something about the character that needed to be changed, and it was as a result of this influx of blacks, West Indians in general, because West Indians from the Caribbean are comprised of a number of different kinds of people, but particularly blacks, who augmented the black population that was already here, that changed the character of this place. I don't think due credit has been given to what really happened.
What kind of books or resources would you recommend to people that are interested in finding more about what happened? And
I'm glad you asked that question, you know, because it just made me think of somebody I think would be good for you to interview. And why is it? I can't remember her name. She wrote the book, The Sir George Party, Dorothy Eber. Mm-hmm. You know, because she attended all the hearings, court hearings, and her book is really, you know, it's a journalistic account of the events at Sir George, because she followed all the proceedings, must have gone through all the newspaper clippings and, you know, and student newspapers and all of that, but she followed the proceedings, interviewed people, and wrote this book, which chronicles what happened at Sir George. And in terms of, it's a very, very important book. I mean, I read it for the first time I read it again a few years back. And the reason I say the book is important because it has a lot of empirical information You know, it's written that kind of way, almost like a day-by-day, blow-by-blow account. So all the kind of day-to-day details that somebody who really steps back and reflects on the whole period after wouldn't talk about, she includes in that book. So it's ended up being a very important historical document where, even though I know that many people that were involved in it at the time sort of critiqued it or criticized it for being this kind of liberal, you know, kind of, you know, it's typical kind of, you know, I'm saying this is their critique. I'm not saying this kind of, you know, like, you know, you get this side, you get that side, you kind of throw them together, and, you know, it's not without, you know, articulating a view necessarily. So, yeah, I think it would. So that's one book. And obviously the book by Dennis Forsyth, Let the Niggers Burn. Unfortunately, beyond going back, which I think is a useful exercise anyway, and it's easy to get articles and read them on the microfiche. It's just such a fascinating thing to see the headlines and read the articles one after the other in the newspapers from in the 60s, particularly like 66, 67, 68, 69. That is, I think, a really interesting exercise on its own, and really helps to inform people about that period in general. There's a documentary that was also done, aired on the History Channel. It's not bad. It's biased in its own way. But it's interesting to see the coverage, like live coverage of, you know, the Sir George Williams incident. Aside from that, and this is one of the unfortunate things, and I think this is a good thing that is happening here now, being in terms of being able to draw the parallels between past and present. You know, David Winks, and there's a little bit of a story that I have to tell you about him, because I read his book. It's like A History of Blacks in Canada, it's called. It's like the first so-called definitive, it's not definitive by any stretch of the imagination, account of African-Canadian history. It's a long book, maybe 600 pages, big book. He wrote that book in the early 70s, published by Yale, it's been republished by McGill and Yale University Press. Republished a few years ago, no appendix, no revisions, nothing. And in the initial, in the first edition, he alludes to Sir George Williams, like in a sentence or two, just in passing. And not only is that dishonest in terms of the impact, and doesn't even touch on like the implications of Sir George in terms of what happened after. But you know, I read the book, and you know, Yale has a very interesting place in world history. George Bush is from Yale. His son, maybe his sons, I know at least George Bush Jr. went to Yale. You know, and I'm saying that there's a movie called The Skulls. I don't know if you've seen it, but it's based on like that secret society thing that they have there, where it's for these people that they're groomed to assume power in the world and all of that. So what I'm saying is not anything that, you know, it's out there. But Yale has trained a number of CIA agents. So I read this book and I said, look, this is not a very good book in terms of the way it's written. It has lots of empirical information. Would this book be useful to? And, you know, I was talking with a friend. I said, you know, I think this guy, you know, Yale University, teaches there, Yale Press. This guy was probably like CIA and was commissioned to write this book to really, you know. And I discovered after that he also produced a pamphlet on a period in the early 19th or late 19th century, early 20th century, when there was talk of federation between Canada and some Caribbean countries. But it was really to make the Caribbean an appendage of Canada. But there was genuine talk about it. And he wrote a little pamphlet on that too. But I just said that to my friend. It was a hunch I had, and I said it to his friend in passing. The friend, you know, got on the internet. The guy's CIA. And openly so. You know. Has been, you know, which is, you know, again, you know, you asked me about books to read, but that's a book to read for its own other reasons in terms of, you know, unfortunately, it's the first major account of African-Canadian history, and alludes to a lot of things that can be elaborated on. There's about 1,000 theses in that book, you know, ideas for about 1,000 theses in that book. But all that is also, I'm making that point to say that, you know, again, some of the lessons that we learn in terms of we don't know who's around us or what purposes people serve. because he must have come here and interviewed all kinds of people and they didn't know who they were talking to. But also that, you know, Sir George has really been neglected. Impact on the world stage, impact locally, and, well, what happened? A number of people from the Caribbean have written indirectly about Sir George as a catalyst for developments in the Caribbean. I think Selwyn Cujo edited a book that includes several essays about black power in Trinidad and so on, that alludes to Sir George. So there are allusions here and there, but in terms of an elaborate book, aside from the book edited by Forsyth and Dorothy Eber, and the book written by Dorothy Eber, and the book by Dorothy Williams, actually, which talks about blacks in Montreal. So there's a section about Sir George, but I have to be honest, since we're saying this for the record, you know, if I'm going to suggest that book, I'd have to be honest and say that there are several quite critical mistakes in terms of understanding who was part of what grouping and about the conference committee, and it kind of minimizes the importance of certain developments that precipitated Sir George, but it's a start. Certain factual things and so on. But, yeah, you know, your question is actually a testament. I mean, the answer to your question is actually a testament to the fact that it's, you know, Sir George Williams, 1969, what happened in February of at that university has been part of the answer, is that it was neglected. I mean, eclipsed by the October crisis shortly after and everything else that unfolded after that. But part of the answer also lies in the fact that, as I mentioned earlier, I think it has some influence on Canada's multiculturalism policy. But, you know, in another way, even though all these things came out of Sir George, many black people, many people from the Caribbean didn't want to talk about it, because for some it was considered a blotch, you know, a sign of shame, whereas for others it was like a badge of honor that we stood up for ourselves in this society. So that there are many reasons, I think, why there's not more material out there on Sir George. And nobody has systematically interviewed people, some of who have died and passed on, some of whom key figures are around. I mean, Rosie, unfortunately, is gone. But I think Rosie spoke about Sir George quite a bit, so his opinion on it is there for the record. There's another man, Norman Cook, works for CEDA. I know him, he's the father of Verda Cook, who's a friend of ours around here. He was actively in events, you know, particularly the follow-up events, in terms of organizing support for the students. Omar Wally, who I had the good fortune to see in Grenada, of Grenadian origin, he is back in Grenada. Had he not jumped bail, he hasn't been to Canada since. He would have gone to prison too, because he was one of the key students. In fact, even more so in some ways than, you know, he was one that we were really targeting. He was a Sir George student, so he would have really been earmarked for prison and whatever else. Yeah, so there's work to be done. And I don't know, maybe there's some PhD or MA theses out there that we don't know about. In terms of full-fledged books, it's a shame.